Blog Talk Radio.
Are you on mute, Arcana? Hey, Lou.
Hi, Pam.
I'm
that was
not
great
so
music, wasn't it?
Headset, but I can't hear him.
Arcana, hello.
Might need to be adjusting his headset or something, or maybe he's on mute. But while we wait for him to figure that out, how has your day been going?
It's been going good. We just did 2 hours with Gray on Front Page Pick. We had so many and such awesome poetry that it is just flowing like a river. So it was a good show. It's just amazing how many talented poets we have in Late Night Poets.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I have to agree. Yeah, I was actually hiding in the background and commenting on some of the poems that got posted in Late Night Poets, but had other things to get done, you know, so, but mm-hmm. I saw that you guys definitely had a wonderful variety of poets. And welcome back, now where'd he go? He dropped.
Hello.
Oh,
no. Hello. Can
there
you
hear
me?
Hi, Arcana.
Hi, I seem to drop there for a moment. Greetings once again, Dark Denizens. This is your midnight host, Arcana Amor, calling out to you from the depths of darkness. With me tonight is my lovely co-host, Luyu Wild Dove, and lurking out there, somewhere in the shadows, is our very own mistress of mayhem, Pam Ray. Good evening, ladies. I hope you're both in the mood to do a spot of delving with me.
Oh, wow.
Well, anybody, Arcana Amor and Mistress of Mayhem? Oh, yes, I'm ready.
Okay, do we have anyone else with us this evening, Pam?
Not at this time.
Okay, that's fine. I think we have a full complement with our lovely coven of lovelies here. So without further ado, strap yourselves in. Let this evening's poetry begin. First, we have a few carryovers before we commence on our descent into darkness of outer space, where no one can hear your screams. So first up, I'm going to put up a piece that's a carryover, and this was from the last contest that we did on the Rose Gallery, and we had a number of actual entries on that piece regarding the Shining, and this was another of them, and we never got a chance to get it read on that occasion. So I'm putting it up now for you. It's called Here's Johnny by Joe Brass. And Pam, would you like to lead this evening by reading that one for us?
Oh, I would be very happy to. Here's Johnny by Joe Brass. Here in this isolated castle, my plot unfolding its bloody gore, removed from prying eyes, no one to hear the screams, trembling with twisted inner psychosis, to slay them all I can no longer wait. Don't rush, only to spoil your plan, spree, spattering blood, breaking bones. Do not go too fast. You'll lose sight from the mutilation to carry out, then bury them under the gardener's greenhouse among pastel tulips, hydrangeas, and spring forsythia. That bitch wife goes first, weak and caught off guard. Drag her by the hair. I'll hang her from the top banister. She'll dangle there, wriggling once still. Child's son will see her scamper off, shrieking in horror. I long to see and hear this. It's so easy from there. Run, run, run to where? When I catch him and hold him, gaze right through him, little son of mine, wants to trust me when I beg his forgiveness for hanging his mother, as light from his eyes drains once he sees the axe tucked behind me. He flies off out the door into the frosty night, focused on the maze of manicured hedges covered with new inches of snow, leaving a set of tiny footprints. End poem.
Great read there, Pam. Okay. So, Luyu, what did you think to that one?
Well, you know what? I always wondered why my neighbor's yard flowers always look so beautiful. Oh, my God. You know, it's just the imagery in here is just deeply frightening. You know, of course, with this child, but, you know, with that last stanza, of course, you know, when you see some erratic, insane person has got an axe behind their back, you know, the thing is that you're running and, you know, this poor child doesn't realize that, you know, he's leaving his footprints for him to follow. But I love the way Pam read this, and this was just sickening as it was frightening.
Great comments there, Lou. So out of interest, is your neighbor partial to a bit of late night gardening then?
Yeah, that's why he has those little night lights out there. That's probably where you got the bodies marked.
Okay, and Pam, you read this piece. What did you think?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I tell you, Joe did an excellent job of capturing the horror and the creepiness within this character and the madness. And I like how you definitely, you hear the voice, you know, of the character, and especially in the lines that bitch wife goes first, we can cut off guard, drag her by her hair, I'll hang her from the top banister. I mean, that whole stanza is just deliciously frightening and really captures the descent of the character into a violent madness. And I really like how Job has captured this man's psychological breakdown leading to his cold and lonely death within the maze. So very well done.
Yeah, absolutely agree with that. Great comment there, Pam. I see Joe mentions in his author notes that his goal was to allow the reader a glimpse into the head of a psychotic killer, where first-hand knowledge of gruesome events are concocted, planned, and carried out. Choosing the iconic scene where Jack Torrance goes on a rampage with intent to gruesomely murder his wife and son with an axe, Joe has penned some very interesting lines of contrasting imagery with his lines. Don't rush, only to spoil your planned spree. Spattering, blood-breaking bones. Do not go too fast. You'll lose sight from the mutilation to carry out. Then bury them under the gardener's greenhouse among pastel tulips, hydrangeas, and spring forsythia. Sitting murder and mutilation beside imagery of tulips, hydrangeas, and forsythias, as if the beauty of their blossoms can keep and disguise the hidden secret that lies beneath them. Joe then goes full tilt into twisted psycho mode with, that bitch wife goes first, weak and caught off guard. Drag her by the hair. I'll hang her from the top banister. She'll dangle there, wriggling. Once still, child son will see her, scamper off shrieking in horror. I long to see and hear this. Cold, ruthless and chilling, demonstrating that at this stage Jack has lost every remaining vestige of his former self and has now been completely possessed by the influence of the ghosts of the Overlook Hotel. Great, intense writing, Joe. Loved it. Okay, so next piece up we're going to put, and I owe an apology to Frank for this one because this one has been waiting in the wings for some time now, and just due to the constraints of getting things in on other shows, there's not been time to do this one before. So we're going to get this one done now for him. And this is called The Bard by Poetic Picasso. And I shall read this one for him myself. The Bard. The magic of her song awakens. Exotic creatures of peasant tales. The lyrical notes of the ancient. Odes of a musical lute played. the passion of the seductive spells, of the sundry illustrations of illusions, uncovering numinous secrets of the bardic tomes of the primordial world, inspiring the war chants of the emboldened ones of valor with the grace and cadence of the words of mystic sagas, and with her sword and armor she bears loyalty to the nobles, but her allegiance is first to the voice of the skaldic winds of time. A traveler of boundless adventures and esoteric knowledge of wisdom, her courage is forged into written versifications of the centurial runes, where the myths of the past stir the fierce breaths of great legends whose names are forever carved in the unforgettable lore of men. She is the quill of the fairies and the lilt of the elves hidden nigh. Her sanctuary is the forest of dreams and the rivers of hope. With her magic, she infuses the spirits of the quiescent ones, and she is the bard of manifold names and reverential poems. End poem. Okay, Pam, what do you think to that one?
Well, first of all, great read there, Arcana. Oh, this was absolutely wonderful. I love how he takes us to, you know, that medieval, you know, adventure, Dungeons and Dragons type rite. And he really carves out the character of the bard, brings her to life in full vision, not only in the world around her, but I especially think that it was important for us to get to know this character in such lines as she bears loyalty to the nobles, but her allegiance is first to the voice of the skaldic winds of time, a traveler of boundless adventures and esoteric knowledge of wisdom. Her courage is forged into written versifications of the central runes. I mean, all the way through, there's amazing lines, but I did pick out those lines because I felt like they were the ones that really best let us get to know the character and who and what she is. So beautifully written and very well done.
Yeah, great comments. I agree with that, Pam. What did you think, Lou?
I thought you did a beautiful read of Frank's poem. You know, I love, you know, through time, many things weren't written down. They were taught by song. They were taught by chants that were repeated. And I loved how he just wrote that, you know, the constant, the magic of her song awakens exotic creatures of pleasant tales, the lyrical notes of the ancient odes of the passion of the seductive spells, you know, the word of tongue that was just passed through time. And, you know, and then there's the second she talks about the he talks about the inspiring war chant, the emboldened, the odes of valor, you know, the way that the ancients sang to their warriors to give them strength for the battle that they were going on. And, you know, I love, just like what Pam, you know, talked about the last stanza, you know, this was epic. It was beautiful, enchanting storytelling, and I enjoyed it very much.
Fabulous comment there, Lou. Yeah. You know, I thought in this one, I just love the skillful wording and imagery in this opening stanza, which instantly grabs the attention. The magic of her song awakens exotic creatures of peasant tales, the lyrical notes of the ancient, odes of a musical lute played, the passion of the seductive spells, of the sundry illustrations of illusions, uncovering numinous secrets of the bardic tomes of the primordial world. There are just too many great lines in this piece to mention them individually. It's so well written. Frank builds this poem in layer upon poetic layer of wonderful words that are sublimely herded dutifully together by his enchanted quill. By the way, he does mention in there a scald. A scald is one of the often named poets who composed scaldic poetry, one of the two kinds of Old Norse poetry, the other being Eddic poetry, hence the title of this piece, The Bard. I've got to take my hat off to Frank for this incredible write. It's simply fantastic. And thank you for sharing it with us, Frank. Okay, so next up we have another piece that's been waiting in the wings for some time now. And this one is called The Lacey Rites by Irish Rose. And for this one, Pam, would you like to read this for us, please?
Sure, I'd be happy to. All right. Demons of hell smolder in filtered light. The Black Sabbath priest stands naked, alone, performing her dark rites. Night exhumes her child once again in a savage birthing delight. Spinning spheres and spatial specters, spirits transcend with musical excision, feeling fire that has been frozen, fiendishly loosed and free again. Time takes rabid bites out of night, savoring it in her transposing splendor, a darkling pronounced and aloof, a credit to her gender. Her blood turns cold, her tongue splits, green scales form devouring delicate flesh. Slowly she's ripped and torn as if by wicked thorns. Eyes glow wings from claw sharp unadorned. The evil heiress of hell now coyly presents herself. Smoke spits from her mouth. Fire burns in her chest. Horns sprout from her head. Craven thoughts tear her mind. She has become that one, evil one called Zorha, a seeker, stalker, and hunter of mankind, a spirit seeking flesh, seeking blood, seeking life, seeking death, that can never be sated, for the hole in hell is endless. It screams inside, always screaming to be fed fresh flesh of the damned. She is a necromancer, a shapeshifter, a conjurer of things that prowl the night, a tainted being hidden among dark shadows. There lurks the carnivore, a predator that sings of her loss neath the blood moonlight, about the ways of death, birth, and life, on songs and chants about the dragons of night. Her altar is now heavily laden with old sacrifice, burgeoning with rotting offal, bodies piled one on the other high, parts of parts ripped and torn apart, crusted blood has now become ensconced upon the altar's clay feet and horns. It is a part and parcel that displays her very honor, claiming as her own the sole order and her cunning over all. With dried bones and seared entrails, smothered in a cloak of fat maggots that have gorged themselves on the gore of gangrene, rot, a poisonous lace trimmed in a green filigree, slime headlights, the morbid scene, a chant begins, beckoning them alive. They groan and grind, fitting and finding their bodies now revived. Methodically, she recites their names as they obediently begin to rise, once free, but now bound to her in demonic seething, forms before her eyes. They are born. End poem. Are you on mute, Arcana?
Yes, I've been mutilating. I do apologize. Yeah, that was an absolutely fantastic read there, Pam. An epic piece, and you did it justice with that fabulous read there. Lou, what did you think to that?
Okay. Well, we go from the demons of hell smoldering in filtered light. The black Sabbath priest stands naked, alone performing her dark rites. Okay, and then, you know, I was just listening to Pam read this, so fabulous. And then it says that smoke spits from her mouth and fire burns in her chest. Horns sprout from her head. Craven thoughts tear her mind. She has become that one evil one called Zora. Okay, and, you know, just like you're just seeing this transformation, this shapeshifter. And then when I was reading, this just was just, you know, of course, this is horror. This just grossed me out. With dried bones and seared entrails, smothered in the cloak of fat maggots. And I just went, gag. I have gored myself on the gore of gangrene. So that just, you know, the horror, it just got even more disgusting. Rat, a poisonous lace trimmed in green filigree. I just like, ah. And so this just, it was epic. It was fabulous. It was detailed. It was just utterly disgustingly delicious, which, you know, it just, the horror of it, it was just fabulous. It was wickedly delicious.
Great comments there, Lou. So you enjoyed it then. Wonderful. And Pam, you read this one. What did you think?
Oh my goodness, this was brilliant, epic darkness. Wonderful word choices, brilliant imagery. And I have to say, some of the imagery definitely gave me the heebie-jeebies. You know, especially the fat, oh man, the with dried bones and seared entrails smothered in a cloak of fat maggots that have gorged themselves on the gore of gangrene. Wow, yeah, that was just some extremely visceral imagery. And wow, but the amazing storytelling, you know, bringing us to the mind and the wickedness of this necromancer who brings her prey back to life and, you know, controls them from that point on. And I like the juxtaposition between the birth and death that is in those end lines. Once free but now bound to her in demonic seething forms before her eyes, they are born. Great rite and very well done.
Yeah, fabulous. Fabulous comments there, Pam. I have to agree. I thought with this piece, the alliteration is off the chart. Gwen really sets the tone here. Spinning spheres and spatial spectres, spirits transcend with musical excision, feeling fire that has been frozen, fiendishly loosed and free again. Then she throws in a touch of subtle rhyme with time takes rabid bites out of night, savoring it in her transposing splendor, a darkling pronounced and aloof, a credit to her gender. The inventiveness and imagination is fabulous throughout, carving wondrous dark landscapes into the reader's mind. The whole piece is a dark triumph of talented writing, where Gwen demonstrates to us her poetic prowess. A truly great, and thank you for sharing this on our show. Okay, so now we are going to move to another piece that I'd like to get in on tonight's show, which is in the theme of the contest that we've had. And for this particular piece, I believe that we have a SoundCloud. And it's by one of my favorite poets on here on AP. It's by our very own Robert M. And here we go. I've put it up. Could we take the SoundCloud away for this one, please, Pam?
Absolutely. Here we go.
This is my recital of Anti-Celestial, a poem inspired by Raymond Chandler. Within the infinite warping maelstrom that is the cosmos, there is great beauty strewn amidst the vast expanse. Yet, for every star that gleams, another is destroyed. For every moment of awe, there is a thousand of woe. Destruction is said to be a catalyst for creation, but sometimes things just cease to be and are embraced by oblivion. I am no different. Since I was young, there had been many hectic storms that wrestled beneath my skin. My mind was like that of a developing universe. Implosions and collisions ensued as chaos had free rein in the realm of the mind. Slowly but surely, the swirling emptiness left its mark. Where there was light, the dark took hold. Where there was hope, reality shook me true. Where there was love, the greatest of voids manifested. And so, in the aftermath of my mind's savage cataclysm, I was left with a new reality. Stars that shone bright were dimmed to nothing. Beauteous entities crumbled to debris, leaving naught of stardust within my hands. Fractured remnants begin their accretion. Amalgamations of animus make their haunts within every ripple and tear, left abundant amidst the ruin of my internal macrocosm. In the space between the spaces rests something darker than darkness. There is where you will find me.
Wow. Okay. Pam, what did you think to that?
Oh, yeah, I really enjoyed that piece by Robert. He has always has a wonderful reading voice. You know, I just, there's so much emotion put into this. It just really tugs at the heartstrings. I thought, you know, he takes the idea of feeling connected to the universe and the emptiness and the destruction within it, and just really expresses, I think, to me, the idea of feeling depressed and lonely in a way that reminds us of how overwhelming it can be to look up at the night sky and all that entails. I really particularly like, and so in the aftermath of my mind's savage cataclysm, I was left with a new reality. Stars that shone bright were dimmed to nothing. Beauteous entities crumbled to debris, leaving naught of stardust within my hands. I mean, oh my goodness, amazing lines all the way through, and just a powerful dark right on the darkness that takes over the mind, and very well done.
Yeah, absolutely. Lou, what did you think to that?
You know, that was a fabulous comment, Pam. You know, with Robert, you know, when there is a difference in people, and there is a darkness they become enveloped by what happens in life. We can look at the stars and we can see the beautiful shining stars in the cosmos. But with others, you know, they look into that darkness, and that is where they exist. And, you know, he brings out that that emptiness between the stars is where he is, where he says, where there was light, the dark took hold. Where there was hope, reality shook me true. Where there was love, the greatest of voids manifested. And so in the aftermath of my mind's savage cataclysm, I was left with a new reality. Stars that shone bright were dimmed to nothing. So, you know, sometimes our life takes us to that darkness, and there is where we choose to reside so that we no longer suffer with what is going on in our hectic life. And like he brings out here, there has been many hectic storms that wrestled beneath my skin. This is just dark and deeply sad.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. I thought, first of all, wow, what an incredible piece by Robert M., whom I must confess is one of my own guilty pleasures, poetically speaking. Robert has taken the chaos of the universe with its eternal yin and yang of birth and destruction in a constant battle between light and darkness, and likened it to the array of emotions the human mind is subjected to on the journey through a lifetime. He then imagines this as a battle being waged within the inner universe of the human mind, where light and darkness are associated with positive and negative emotions. It is deeply sad how Robert describes this with, since I was young, there had been many hectic storms that wrestled beneath my skin. My mind was like that of a developing universe. Implosions and collisions ensued as chaos had free rein in the realm of my mind. Slowly but surely, the swirling emptiness left its mark. It's as if Robert has dismissed the light completely, and his mindset dwells in a universe of darkness. Though without light, darkness cannot exist, since darkness itself is defined as the absence of light. This next passage I found to be an amazing expression and use of metaphor. And so, in the aftermath of my mind's savage cataclysm, I was left with new reality. Stars that shone bright were dimmed to nothing. Beauteous entities crumbled to debris, leaving naught of stardust within my hands. Fractured remnants begin their accretion. Amalgamations of animus made their haunts within every ripple and tear, left abundant amidst the ruin of my internal macrocosm. In the space between the spaces rests something darker than darkness. There is where you will find me. Darker than darkness. I love that phrase. Creating a place where even the darkness pales by comparison as to how deeply the mind can sink into dolor and despair in a void of empty. The wonderful recital in Robert's dulcet tones also adds to the atmosphere, breathing life and depth into his words. A stunning write here by Robert M., and an honest, revealing portrayal of depression and mental anguish. It is a deeply distressing piece to read for any empath, yet also an immersive experience revealing the creativity and eloquence that can still reside within depression. A simply incredible piece, Robert, and thank you for sharing it with us for the show. Okay, moving on. So the next piece I'm going to put up now is called Methane Flakes Drift by Sam Sampson. So for this piece, Luyu, would you like to give this one a go?
Yes, I would. And give me a second. It uploads. Okay, here we go. Methane Flakes Drift by Sam Sampson. Standing in the basin, Sputnik plus Nitra. Methane flakes drift as I shift my feet. I gaze at the rising sun. dim light, a haze in the thin atmosphere. I shall die here soon. Knew it was a one-way trip for the benefit of mankind, they said, to help us reach the stars, aptly named for the god of the end world. Yet here, hell has frozen over, Sharian in near orbit, tidal locked. I have a cone for the ferryman. I turn to look at the belt and beyond to the stars, hoping my sacrifice will not be in vain. In poem.
Yeah, great read there, Lou. You put a lot of feeling into that that really, really made it shine. Pam, what did you think to that?
Oh, this is beautiful and wonderful read there, Lou. I really like how he creates with the imagery and the word choices, the loneliness of this hero who has made this sacrifice. And he's told a story without a lot of lines, and it's a story with an in-depth, detail of telling of heroism and sacrifice. I really like how it opens up with the science fiction type element of standing in the basin, Sputnik Planitia, methane flakes drift as I shift my feet. I gaze at the rising sun. And within that moment, you can picture that image in your head. And then goes to a reference death in a mythological way at the end with the Sharian in near orbit, tidal locked. I have coin for the ferryman. I turn to look at the belt and beyond to the stars, hoping my sacrifice will not be in vain. I like that end line because I think even if you aren't a hero who's made some sort of sacrifice, I think we all kind of hope that our life will not be in vain in our last moments. I think we oftentimes, I imagine people looking back and thinking upon their deathbed whether or not, what they offered up to this world or even to their family and friends was in vain or not. So wonderful write and very well done.
Yeah, fabulous comment there, Pam. Lou, you read this one. What did you think to that?
This was such a powerful brevity, going along with Pam's comments. It just makes me wonder how many times those that have gone into the deep sea or those that have gone into space, when they say goodbye to their family and friends, realizing that they may never come back. And then, to take that journey and to, and even though he knows that he's not coming back, he looks at the beauty, he looks at the rising sun, where he is, and then realizes that he's not going to make it back home, but he looks at the stars. And then, of course, the many different thoughts that we think of before we're dying. And, of course, he went towards the mythological storytelling of this, which just tied us into the future and into the past where, Pam had read that he has the coin for the ferryman, and he's looking at the stars, and he's hoping, his heart is hoping that his death is not in vain.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. In fact, you've actually picked up on something that I was going to mention myself there, Lou. I really like Henry's visualization of standing on the surface of Pluto, which is something I was looking for in the contest. I wanted people to give me their take on standing on an alien world and surveying the surroundings and telling me what they saw and felt from it. And in this one, you know, through surveying these unfamiliar surroundings, he shows great imagination by turning this into a tale of being marooned on an inhospitable planet, counting down the remaining moments of his ebbing life, all in the name of advancing humanity's understanding of this distant world.
Mm-hmm.
Aptly named for the god of the underworld. Yet here, hell has frozen over. Charon, in near orbit, tidal locked. I have coin for the ferryman. I turn to look at the belt and beyond to the stars, hoping my sacrifice will not be in vain. Charon's orbit around Pluto takes 6.4 Earth days, and one Pluto rotation, a Pluto day, takes 6.4 Earth days. Charon neither rises nor sets, but hovers over the same spot on Pluto's surface, and the same side of Charon always faces Pluto, which is what is referred to as tidal locking. In conjunction with what you said, Lou, though imagine this is a very real choice that astronauts take, being aware that it might end up being a one-way trip with limited help if things go wrong and no hope of rescue. The whole piece captures the bleakness of this alien terrain as a backdrop to an unfolding melodrama in a life or death struggle, imaginative, intriguing, and well written. A great piece by Sam Sampson. Okay, so up next we have a piece called Adrift by Uncle Ernie. And I shall read this one myself. Adrift by Uncle Ernie. I am still here, all alone with my fear. It's been so long since someone else was near. My memories, those still burn strong. As I relive the day, it all went wrong. The sounds, smells, explosions under an onyx sky. No survivors, not one. All of us so young. Back on Earth, they immortalized us in song. Dead I am, yet my spirit remains here, on a planet where one day lasts a year. Rhyme or logic, for it is unclear. No reason for the agony I must prolong. I'm adrift, knowing my loved ones never got to hear. Goodbye. End poem. Pam, what did you think?
This is another one I really like. I have to say there has definitely been, you know, there's quality rights in this contest for sure. You know, I think there's something about outer space that brings out the philosophers in us, especially when it comes to the end of life. You know, these last couple of rites make me think of the movie Armageddon. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's just, you know, it's like, I really like the first-person narrative that Uncle Ernie uses and how he takes a single voice that has no one else around in the moment of their dying. They're far away from family and friends, and their spirit is now simply floating in this dark chasm of space. And I really like this all the way through, but I thought it was perfect to end with the word goodbye. But another part I really liked was no survivors, not one, all of us so young, back on Earth, they immortalize us in song. Dead I am, yet my spirit remains here. So, you know, you just imagine the fear and the horror in the last seconds before this person's death, and now their spirit is just trapped in this vacuum of loneliness, while meanwhile on Earth, he's immortalized in song. So excellent writing, very well done.
Yeah, absolutely. Lou, you, what did you think?
You know, for me, when I was listening to this being read, you know, this is so visual, you know, because you get sent out into space and there's comfort knowing that there's other astronauts with you, you know, other scientists in there with you going to this, you know, this planet. You know, and of course there's a fear that something may go wrong and you may not come back home. But when you take off and you have that comfort of having another human being with you, you know, and then as things go wrong, you know, the sounds, the smell, the explosions under the onyx sky, and then you realize that you're the only survivor and that everyone that you came with is no longer there, you know, that all, you know, he says, no survivors, not one, all of us so young, you know, and to be in that situation and knowing, you know, that time is passing differently where you are than for those on the earth, and to, you know, just the thought of them singing songs of your bravery, you know, that you're immortalized, but yet there you are in space frozen forever and not being able to tell your loved ones or your friends goodbye. You know, those are the thoughts that are frightening and, you know, that I can imagine that they're thinking of as they make this journey. It's just deeply heartbreaking.
Yeah, very emotive comment there, Lou. I'm with you on that. I thought that there was strong imagery conveyed here by Terry, once again bringing in a human involvement on the distant world of Venus. In this piece, Uncle Ernie imaginatively explores the idea of actually dying on this planet, where the spirit remains trapped far from its home world and can only lament those left far behind with a ghostly farewell. Dead I am, yet my spirit remains here, on a planet where one day lasts a year. Rhyme or logic, for it is unclear, no reason for the agony I must prolong. I'm adrift, knowing my loved ones never got to hear. Goodbye. A day on Venus is longer than a year. It takes Venus longer to rotate once on its axis than to complete one orbit of the Sun. That's 243 Earth days to rotate once, the longest rotation of any planet in the solar system, and only 224.7 Earth days to complete an orbit of the Sun. A very thought-provoking piece that Uncle Ernie has penned here that not only explores Venus, but also explores ideas of what may happen to the immortal spirit after death. Great writing there, Terry. Okay, so the next piece I'm going to put up is a piece called... Here we go. It's called The Warbringer's Forge by Leela, and I shall read this one for you. Drums' harsh clamour heralds grim dawn, their bronzen voices dulled by rust. The war god moves, blood on his shields still wet. Blood seeps into scorched soil, staining the earth like rusted wounds. Mars triumphant. The Seventh Legion's blaring battle hymn shatters the stillness, ringing in my ears, their armor glinting vermilion in the hot copper tang of enemies' gore. The nauseating smell of spilled blood fills my nostrils. Mars exulti. I stand amidst the charnel plain, where our swords carved stark verses unto foe's flesh versus crimson, that sate my wrath like rust on parched lips. My limbs ache, breath rasps in my throat. Martis vis, vir mihi para. How long must your hunger rule the tide, rousing souls for this vicious motion? My legion withdrew through citadels aflame into abysmal shadows, smoky realm like Phlegethon. My feet kicking up blood-damp dust, spear shaft wet and slippery in hand. Mars triumphant. War, mirrored in this desolation, wails at our straying, its fury awakened within me. Singing a dire hymn in whatever arms death bestows, Martis sanguine me uva. Though my limbs fail, my will remains unyielding, my purpose to fight till my final breath, until this warbringer who forged me in strife releases me and my blades, singing their requiem in my enemy's blood, paint the wasteland newly red with my life's last crimson gift. Mars, exulti. End poem. Pam, what do you think?
Well, first of all, that was an excellent read there. This is brilliant with its imagery and its metaphors and the way she captures a character, a man of war who serves Mars and with his blood and his breath, who has basically been forged to be a warrior, to follow those ways. And I really particularly like war mirrored in this desolation, wails at our straying, its fury awakened within in me, singing a dire hymn in whatever arms death bestows. And I like that in whatever arms death bestows, because it makes me think of the idea that we don't really, especially I imagine it being a warrior, and you know you have that chance of dying on a battlefield, but you cannot predict when and where that battlefield will be. So absolutely a powerful write and very well done.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with that. Well, what did you think to that one, did you?
You know, you did such a wonderful read of Leah's poem. You know, this is, the gods and, humanity and the worship of the role of between how the gods ruled over themselves and also over humans. And, we see so many movies and read so many tales of, especially the gods of war, how exhausted at times they were from the battle. And I thought that she caught that up wonderfully here, where she goes, my legion withdrew through citadels of flame into abysmal shadows, smoky realm like the Pentathon, my feet kicking up the blood-damp dirt, spear shift wet and slippery in hand, Mars triumphant, and she just caught with her imagery. For me, right there in that stanza, the roles of the gods that they were given and what they had to do to survive when they were given these roles. And I bet she wonderfully caught it there in that imagery where you could see it.
Yeah, great comments there. Okay, so what Leela has done here is she's thrown in a little bit of Latin in there in a few places. So exulti, obviously exalted. Martis visa via mi cara. Tuesday you want strength, prepare for me. Martis sanguine me uva, blood of Tuesday, help me. The references to Tuesday are because Roman gods became Nordic weekday names. The god Tyr or Til, identified with Mars, after whom Tuesday is named. Sunday was the day the sacred to the sun. Monday the moon, Tuesday Tyr, Wednesday Odin, Thursday Thor, Friday Frigga, and Saturday Loki. The name of each day sounds fairly similar to its corresponding god, with the exception of Saturday, which is often mistakenly assumed to be the name for the Roman god Saturn. A spellbinding rite here from Leela that made a well-deserved front-page pick and also reads like a Shakespearean tragedy. It is so beautifully worded. Right from the opening two lines. Drums' harsh clamour heralds grim dawn, their bronzen voices dulled by rust. It reels the reader into its fascinating imagery that perfectly portrays the red planet and its mythology with eloquent metaphors. Her Latin exclamations add an air of authenticity to the atmosphere of this piece too. I really enjoy the way Leela writes and her wonderful spectrum of vocabulary and imagination. They make for a perfect marriage in this inspired piece. It has drama, bloodlust, in the flailing fury of battle, stoic determination to fight on regardless of seemingly insurmountable odds, always confident of a triumphant outcome. All the qualities you would associate with the god of war. She also uses visual metaphors with reference to colour throughout. Bronze and voices dulled by rust. Blood seeps into scorched soil, staining the earth like rusted wounds. Armour glinting vermilion in the hot copper tang of enemies' gore. Paint the wasteland newly red with my life's last crimson gift. Each verse is so skillfully crafted, it's almost impossible to pick out any particular note, and they're all equally as good. This is clearly an inspired rite from a very gifted poet. Bravo, Leela. Okay, the next piece I'm going to put up is called The Mercy of Mercury by Daniel Dechino. And Pam, would you like to give this one a read for us, please?
Absolutely. The sins of man are most punishable within the mind of a criminal. I couldn't imagine living life before the 40th century in an overcrowded, underappreciated world. How did one ever escape without personal spacecraft, with annihilation as a genealogical constant? Humanity survived, although never learned. I suppose most infants don't fully learn till they're well into adulthood, and many still not then. Humanity at barely tens of thousands of years old still had a lot of growing pains, and as one of them, I now had nothing but time to contemplate these things, as the past is a permanent scar, unhealed and festering. I am constantly in pain at what became a criminal, a burden on society, selfish, and I had the great misfortune to finally have realized this, as captured men often do. And as escape opened a rare door, I entered it and chose self-exile in deep space, mostly from cowardice, as my ridiculing mind reminds me every second. And now, through a series of technical mishaps and pilot stupidity, I come seemingly to the end of days during my penance purgatory, stranded on Mercury. I am now a creature of twilight, having to constantly move and follow the sharp edge of shadow, every day meters distance between burning and freezing hell. What was the the middle circle again. Wrath, who knew it meant the punishment and not the sin, self-inflicted as it is. If only my own thoughts weren't my soulmate, constantly retell stories of what brought me here, I might have found peace. Instead, today, as the life support system finally failed, it's the first time I've smiled since landing on this wretched rock. It'll be over soon. And to those who find this cautionary tale I leave buried in the ground, may it help you in some way, my final feeble attempt at some good. I'm sorry for what I've done, and I miss the earth. I hope it's okay. Regards, a homeless lost soul, atoned with the malice and mercy of mercy.
Great read, Pam. Luyu, what did you think?
Man, she did a wonderful read of this. You know, this reminds me so much of somebody who is stranded on an island and they find some way to write a note and throw it in the bottle and throw it out to sea and hope that somebody finds it. You know, this was written not so much that this is him, but in a personal tale about, you know, where he says the sins of man are most punishable within the mind of a criminal, you know, to be sent to Mars and to realize the sins of your past and trying to atone for it. And, you know, he brings that out. He says, if only my thoughts weren't my soulmate, constantly retelling stories of what brought me here, why he was there. And it says that he's finally found peace. And, you know, he says, at those who find this cautionary tale, I leave buried in the ground, may it help you in some way. My final feeble attempts at some good, you know, and, you know, sometimes it's not in loneliness that we find what we've done and then hope in some way that we can repay and do some good to make up for the sins that we've committed. Even though we know we're dying, we hope that we get forgiveness in some way. At least that's how I felt when I was listening to Pam Lee Daniels' poem.
Yeah, great comments there, Luyu. And that's a wonderful simile that you drew there with the message in a bottle thrown out from a desert island. Yeah, that really works with this piece. Pam, you read this one. What did you think?
Oh, this is amazing. It's a wonderful dark tale a man who, while lost, in space, tries to do some good to make up for his mistakes. And I like that that's the main message of it. But I also felt like Daniel did a brilliant job of connecting with his chosen prompt. You know, as you say in your notes on your contest that you ran, Mercury is a dead planet and the most heavily cratered object in the solar system. And then you also say, without an atmosphere, Mercury is a silent world without any sound. So you can imagine this man trapped on Mercury, knowing it's his last moment and being surrounded by nothing but silence and these heavy craters. And then I also thought he did well on putting in elements of the actual god Mercury, with who is the god of financial gain. And I thought that connected well with it because nowadays, you know, we think of people who ride into space, you know, as being rich enough to be able to afford it. And also that, you know, the god of travelers, trickery, thieves. So you can imagine that this traveler to space, this person who has wronged others, turning to Mercury in hopes of finding some mercy. So just an amazing light. and very well done.
Yeah, great summary of the piece there, Pam. I felt Daniel has also taken the route of being stranded on Mercury as he leaves behind his dying lament for posterity, almost finding inner peace during his dying thoughts as his life support systems deplete. His protagonist's life became a sham. Unhappy with the rules of a corrupted society, he chose the path of the outlaw, becoming imprisoned for his crimes and managing to somehow escape his fate, seeking solace, exploring distant planets as a wandering hermit. I like the way Daniel involves the reader in the thoughts and emotions of his character, visualizing the vista of Mercury with, I am now a creature of twilight, having to constantly move and follow the sharp edge of shadow every day, meters distance between burning and freezing hell. Mercury is not tidally locked to the sun, as it spins slowly on its axis and completes one rotation every 59 Earth days. A fascinating piece here, imaginatively penned and weaved into a tale of escape, exile, and alienation from humanity that ultimately ends in regret. Great writing there, Daniel. Thank you. Okay, so the next piece I'm going to put up is a bit of an epic. So what I thought we could do with this one, if you're all up for it, is rather than having one of us read the whole piece, take it in turns, because the whole piece is in three parts. So I thought we could perhaps start with Luyu, then move on to Pam,
okay.
And then I would read the final chapter. Are you all up for that?
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay with you, Pam?
That sounds good with me.
Okay.
It's a little bit different, but hey, let's give it a go. So, Luyu,
okay.
If you want to start with chapter one of this piece, which is called Arrivals by Silent Tree.
Mission date, 2332, Starship Juno, destination Mars. Chapter 1, The Birth. After 32 years hooked up to a cryogenic capsule, the engines cut out as crackles of fluorescent tubes stuttered into life once again. The thawing sensation has lulled me from my slumber, a head full of feathers. The fragments left buried now fade as an acritic migraine screams. I slowly opened my eyes as a rush of blurred colors melted away the many years of darkness and the underwater echoes of fishbowl dreams. The burn of the red prism beam scanning my retina drowns out a hive of binary typewriter printers, the growing depth still grinding inside of my ears. As sickness washes over me, the pulse feels blow and the shallow ache awakens a wave of stale breath held caged within my burning chest. The bolts chafe against the ice as the hinges squeal. The doors hiss as I stumble and fall to my knees, the puppet wires still trailing from my back. A dry, wretch wet my desert throat as the pins and needles in my hands subside, I gently peel the electrode sensor pads from my pale goose flesh. As my naked body convulses, I rustled against the tremors to regain my footing, glancing at the pulsing console, a radio star signal message received.
Dear two, the message. I steadied myself against a locker as I began to dress, first pulling on my thermal undergarments, then struggled with the tethered bonds of my flight suit, shuffling across the floor. My bones ached within every step taken to raise the cinder block boots. I collapsed down and sat before the strobing console. As I slipped my access card into the terminal, the control panel burst to life. My gloved fingers cued the button sequence of the startup procedure. I let out a sigh as each system gradually came back online, turning to the external system. I flicked up the resin-covered switch to retract the window shutters. The segmented blades grated as they snapped back against the hull to unveil the dwarf planet of Mars, a corroded, hued landscape of windswept iron grains. In awe, I let the rusted image bathe my eyes for a moment before I turned attention to the radio signal console and switched to manual syntax control. The single origin dated 2999 was broadcast on repeat, a broken record of garbled radio static. Aside from the barely audible words storm, temple, and gate, I turned to the navigation console to scan localized frequencies, finally locking on to the radio beacon. Location, the Scientific Research Laboratory, Arcadia.
Chapter 3, The Descent. Having located the source of the transmission, those words echoed deep inside my head. Storm, temple, gate. What had they uncovered down there? Why had we lost contact with the colonists? How the 33 years of silence occurred, and what fate awaited me on the Martian surface? Questions yet unanswered. With weighted thoughts still swirling, I began to prep the shuttle for departure, loading the extra oxygen bottles, a security bypass kit, and meal provisions to the cart. I sat before the main control console to run through the drop procedures as a board of bulbs gradually burnt green, bringing each shuttle system back online. My gloved hands twisted the ridged flywheel counterclockwise, releasing the cylinder bolts, securing the airlock hatch to the shuttle module. After transferring the supplies inside, I strapped myself down into the flight seat. I brought the HUD display online and initiated the decoupling process. End poem. Okay, Pam, what did you think to that?
Oh, man, this is epic. And a very cool idea to have us separate the reads. I really liked her imagery in this. She has, Silent Tree has a gift for storytelling. I definitely look forward to reading more of this story. And again, we have a great tale on someone who is left alone with their own thoughts and with the idea of the end of life and being trapped in space. And I really like that. I would like to read more of Science Fiction Writes by Silent Tree because she seems to do this very well. I can't help but think that probably she's somebody who watches a lot of Star Trek or reads a lot of, Isaac Asimov or something because she has the technical elements that you'd expect in a sci-fi write, and yet that the emotional and human elements of the story don't get buried beneath the technology, which can easily happen. I really like a dry wretch wets my desert throat as the pins and needles in my hands subside. I gently peel the electrode sensors pads from my pale goose flesh. And there's just wonderful lines all the way through and just very well done.
Yeah, great. You know what? I couldn't agree with you more, Pam. The only difference is you cited Star Trek. To me, this sort of put me in mind of the Alien movies, you know, where they're sort of like in deep cryogenic stasis, and as they approach a planet, you know, there's that beacon that sort of summons them all awake, and they all come out of this cryogenic stasis, waking up. Before they descend to the planet to investigate. It kind of put me in mind of that whole thing. I felt the entire piece reads like a story. And by the way, wonderful reads from both of you. And I thought it worked quite well, the three of us reading it. The entire piece reads like a story with off-the-chart imagery and descriptive passages that reel the reader in and holds the attention due to the skillful way it has been written. It is like watching a movie in the mind's eye that is gripping and you just want to see more. Cassandra has limited the story to the beginning of what could become an epic tale that demands to be written in full at some point. After 32 years, hooked up to a cryogenic capsule, the engines cut out as crackles of fluorescent tubes stuttered into life once again. The thawing sensation has lulled me from my slumber. A head full of feathers, the fragments left buried now fade as an Arctic migraine screams. I slowly open my eyes as a rush of blurred colours melted away the many years of darkness and the underwater echoes of fishbowl dreams. The descriptive use of metaphor is amazing and so detailed. It makes you feel as if you're there, experiencing each emotion in real time, which is testimony to Cassandra's written skills. I felt that, you know, all I can say is I'm absolutely in awe of this piece, the level of detail that Silent Tree has gone into. I'm left wondering, what is the meaning of storm, temple, gate? What had they uncovered down there? I think it's to be continued, and I'm itching to find out. Wonderful writing, Silent Tree. What did you think, Lou?
What I liked about this, going along with everybody's comments, because I don't want to be repetitive, is not only was the detail spectacular, but she made it personal, where you felt like you were actually watching this space traveler, this astronaut going through this, and the fear and everything that she felt, you know, like, you know, she talks about what year it is and the birth and how she awakes and, you know, how she, you know, talks about that she has this migraine that's screaming and then, you know, the blurring lights, you know, when you wake up and you're disoriented. And, you know, she talks about how the sickness washes over her as the pressure fields below. You can just literally see this, you know, where she's getting on her knees. And then she starts to get, you know, worried, like, you know, she's wondering why she's lost contact with the colony. And then she just, like, you could just see her going into automatic, you know, getting ready, you know, where she says that she's in awe that I let the rusted image bathe my eyes for a moment before I turn attention to the radio signal console. And then she sees that it's $29.99 that's being broadcast over and over. And then she goes into the descent where she starts getting ready to, you know, go on to Mars, and she walks us through everything. We can see everything happen as if we were watching a space movie, and this is a stranded astronaut on this planet trying to survive, And she does. She gets ready into the main controls, into the systems, and you know, she walks us through everything and just leaves you hanging because you want to know what's going to happen to this astronaut and why she's lost. You know, will she ever get in contact with the colony? Will she survive? And so she leaves us hanging, wanting for more.
Totally agree with that. Yeah, great, great observations there, Louie. So the next piece I'm going to put up now is by our very own Pam. And Pam kindly asked me to read this one for her. I'm going to give it a go. And it's called Septimus by Pam Ray. Finis gloria venit ad esse. The end of glory has come to pass. I am Septimus. I was a warrior, equestrian, and citizen of the noble city of Rome. I was a worshipper and follower of the supreme deity, Jupiter. I was from a family of wealth and prestige. Men envied and admired me. Women willingly gave themselves to me. Mine was the life of a man, blessed by the gods. Then came the one thing which changes the course of a man's destiny. I speak not of war or the whim of the gods, but of love, vicious and enticing love. She was Vodicea, a Gaul and favoured house slave of Tiberius Lucius, a most esteemed member of the Roman Senate. Like many men, my weakness rests in the arms of instant gratification, so I gave no thought to the consequences of taking this woman to be my own. I was obsessed beyond madness with my need for this enchanting woman, who belonged to a man of wealth and power. I went and made an offering at the shrine of Jupiter Optimus Maximus, that he may bless my endeavours to claim the flesh and spirit of Odysseus. I foolishly believed. He saw that my offering was good, as had been my loyal service to him. Whenever possible, Vodicea and I met in secret for the union of our flesh. Then, one day, as I wandered alone, Horna the Elder approached me. She was a well-known prophetess and witch, who was both feared and admired. Her unnerving, pale gaze had held me tight. She had spoken a voice that was like the rubbing of stone against stone. Carve hominem equorum. Beware of the horses. Jupiter has spoken unto me that I may offer up to you a warning. Vodicea, the Gaul, will be the death of you. Walk away from her that you may continue to live a fruitful life. I sneered at the witch with the cocksure attitude of a man in his prime. I do not believe that the king of the gods would speak through someone as lowly as yourself. If Jupiter has message for me, he can deliver it himself. And so he did. Now, I'm a hunted man with a bounty on my head. For while Vodicea gave me her body, she remained always loyal to the house of Lucius. My side has been pierced by a spear. My blood is pouring forth. These are my final moments. And I know I should be calling out to Jupiter for his mercy and forgiveness. But instead, I moan in a death-soaked wail. Vadice cum tradis. Cunte amavi toto cordimeo. Vodicea, Why do you betray me when I loved you with all my heart? Now, as Vidos approaches, I cannot think upon eternal consequences, but rather only on the wretched pain of love that deceives. I look towards the heavens and scream, Jupiter fulgo interficita me in autonum muto oblivsica monstri quod est amore. Jupiter's lightning, kill me forever to forget the monster that is love.
Mm.
Okay, so Lou, what did you think to that?
Well, you did a fantastic read of Pam Ray's poem. This was epic storytelling. The imagery and the emotions were just powerful. You could just see the pride, you know, regardless, you know, he fell in love with this woman and he did not care that she was the servant of a powerful citizen of Rome. And regardless, he was even given warning to stay away from her because it would be the death of him. But, you know, I liked where she said, you know, sometimes when we don't want to hear or we're given advice that will benefit us, but our heart tells us otherwise, you know, it's like somebody giving us advice. It's like rubbing two stones together. It's hurtful and it grazes against what we want and what we believe. And then, you know, there it is there with pride. You know, pride has known to bring many down, whether they're human or they are a god of themselves. And, you know, he didn't listen and he ended up having to pay for not listening, even though he was given advice that it would be the death of him. And it literally was the death of him. And I really loved the Latin in here, the way Pam put this in here. It's written very well. It's easy to understand. And, you know, it was just, I just enjoyed it, Pam. It's one of the things you've written. Fabulous.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, great, great comment there, Liu Yu. And I don't know if it was intentional. I felt that this film has echoes of the film Gladiator with Russell Crowe. was that intentional,
kind of
Pam? Finis Gloria. Finis Gloria Venita Dice. The end of glory has come to be. We know from the beginning that you're about to treat us to an inspired rite, Pam. This has echoes of the film Gladiator, as I've said, that is beautifully written and demonstrates a lot of forethought with stunning word choices by keeping it in period with ancient Rome, using Latin exclamations to dramatize and accentuate certain passages. The wording carries such authenticity that it makes you feel like you've stepped back in time to ancient Rome, with all the backstabbing, conniving, treachery and hedonism that prevailed in a corrupt totalitarian society of politically hidden agendas. The poetic language used is wonderful, as usual, and this is an extraordinary piece that fits in perfectly with the mythological aspect of Jupiter, king of the gods. What a fabulous epic piece you've penned here, Pam. Mm-hmm. And thank you so much for writing this for tonight's show and sharing it with us. Wonderful.
My pleasure. And thank you for the inspiration and the amazing read there. I really appreciate that.
Bless you. Thank you for that, Pam. Okay, so let's carry on. And the next piece I'm going to put up is, let's have a look, see where we are. Okay, the next piece I'm going to put up is by Jenny the Deep. And it's called Pluto Descends, and it's coming up on the board now. There we go. Do you? Would you like to give this one a go? Are you on mute, Lou? Hello, is anybody there?
Well, I know I am. And I see Lou, and I don't see her saying on the board, be right back. But maybe she's coughing.
Yes, it could well be. Yeah, yeah. Okay, in that case, Pam, would you like to give this one a read for us?
Sure, absolutely. Pluto coldly denounced, falling like its red snow, blue skies and spinning moons vanish, sacrificed in vain is its planet's name. A heart-shaped glacier chips away, floating away from space, descending as Pluto. Dispensed, methane freezes, suffocation spreading, like a wildfire burning, from with nowhere to go now but down, descending to the underworld. Dread was brought, also his luck and love he dispensed. Darkness now resides where Pluto once declared home, a stolen home and stolen wife, makes his mightiness weak, grieving his life. Lost it all, his name and glory, stuck now filled with darkness. End poem.
Yeah, great read, Pam. Thank you for that. Do we have Lou back with us now?
She says that she got dropped and her phone is not letting her connect.
Okay.
I think I see her. Hold on. Here we go. Welcome back, Lou.
Hi, Lou.
Hi. Sorry. I don't know what happened.
No need for apologies.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
No need to. Listen, did you get a chance to hear any of that, Lou?
No, I was trying to get back. I'm sorry.
No problem. Okay.
I can read while y'all are commenting.
That's okay. In that case,
okay.
I'll start with the comments on this one. So I think that this is an inspired write from Jenny that displays an evolution in her poetry. The lucid, descriptive imagery perfectly captures the picture sent back from New Horizons, which was launched from Cape Canaveral in January 2006. The probe used a flyby of the giant planet Jupiter to increase its velocity to more than 30,000 miles an hour, reaching Pluto, the largest Kuiper Belt object, on the 14th of July 2015, and beaming data back to Earth with Pluto, coldly denounced, falling like its red snow, blue skies and spinning moons vanish, sacrificed in vain is its planet's name. A heart-shaped glacier chips away, floating away from space, descending is Pluto. She goes on to explore the mythology of Pluto and Hades with darkness now resides where Pluto once declared home. A stolen home and stolen wife makes his mightiness weak, grieving his life. Lost it all, his name and glory, stuck now filled with darkness. This stanza relates to Hades' abduction of his wife to be Persephone. Persephone did not submit to Hades willingly, but was abducted by him while picking flowers in the fields of Nysa. In protest of his act, Demeter, Persephone's mother, cast a curse on the land, and there was a great famine, though one by one the gods came to request she lift it, lest mankind perish and cause the gods to be deprived of their receiving gifts and sacrifices. Demeter asserted that the earth would remain barren until she saw her daughter again. Zeus, Persephone's father, then sends for his son Hermes and instructs him to go down to the underworld in hopes that he may be able to convince Hades to allow Persephone to return to Earth so that Demeter might see Persephone and cause the famine to stop. Persephone is questioned and admits that she ate food of the dead whilst in the company of Hades. And she tells Demeter that Hades gave her a pomegranate seed and forced her to eat it. Persephone is eating that actually led to dismay from Demeter. Zeus, however, had previously proposed a compromise to which all parties had agreed. Of the year, Persephone would spend one-third with her husband. And it is during this time, when Persephone is down in the underworld with her husband, that winter falls upon the earth, an aspect of sadness and mourning. I think this is an inspired write from Jenny, and one of her best pieces to date, in my humble opinion. I also like the form that she's written in with her patterns of words. I feel it's a great piece, and very well done, Jenny. Loved it. And Pam, what did you think to this?
Oh, this was definitely brilliant. I do like that she chose the Rictometer form, because I think those, it makes the stanzas actually kind of look like little planets, and just really works well with the theme. I like that she first writes about Pluto the planet, and her first opening lines are Pluto coldly denounced. You know, it's that back and forth of, you know, people not being able to decide whether Pluto is a planet or not. And then goes into the mythology of Pluto, the god of the underworld. I really like the imagery of dispensed methane freezes, suffocation spreading like a wildfire burning. And then a stolen home and stolen wife makes his mightiness weak, grieving his life. Wonderful lines all the way through, and very well done.
Yeah, great comment there, Pam. Okay, so I think we've got time to get another piece in. So this next one I'm going to put up is by Dark and Auras, and it's called Saturns on Saturn. So on this one, Lou, would you like to give this one a read?
Yes, thank you. Saturns on Saturn by Darkened Arias. To you, Earthling, far, far away, my planet may look like a red desert lost to the sands of time. My name is Sa. And yes, during the day it must look like a chunk of dirt, but come the night I chime. Powerful hymns, ice particles spray, a ring of loveliness they exert. It is our nursery rhyme. To lull little ones to sleep, the rings go round and sweep, and shining lights go by. A memory that they keep. The rings, they just get bigger as the years go by because of what they truly are, so that I cannot lie. The particles are held together by the souls of those that died. My name is Sa. I turn on Saturn, a flowing, glowing pattern of loved ones ever encircling their pride, and to dreamland to be their guide. End poem.
Great read there, Lou. Wonderful. Okay, Pam, what did you make of that?
This was just absolutely delightful. I love how she tells this story through this character, this alien named Saw. And, you know, I always thought if I could play on any planet, it would probably be Saturn with the rings, you know, to treat it like to ride on the rings as if they were merry-go-rounds. There's something just so mystical and magical about this. And she brings in the characteristics of Saturn, like the ice particle sprays, and the rings, but she also brings in a great element of fantasy storytelling. A ring of loveliness exerts it. It is our nursery rhyme to lull little ones to sleep. The rings go round and sweep, and shining lights go by, a memory that they keep. And You know, just a great introduction to this. I can imagine getting more rights that have to do with this character and all that they observe from where they sit upon the rings of Saturn and sing their songs. So wonderful, right, and very well done.
Great observations there, Pam. And Lou, you read this one. What did you think?
You know, this is beautiful because, you know, it's talking to the earthlings where, you know, you're looking at me, but, you know, what do you think of me? I'm just a red planet with, you know, dust going around and, you know, that's all you see is that chunks of dirt. But then she says, if you really look deeper, you know, it says that these rings are what put the little ones to sleep. And those rings are the bodies, you know, and in fact, there was, I think in Star Trek, where they would shoot the bodies into space, and it was like a protective ring to protect their planet and, you know, the place with the mortuary where the bodies were shot out into the rings that provided safety and beauty. For them, it was something of beauty. And this is what I loved about this is that she says, my name is Sa, I turn on Saturn, a flowing, glowing pattern of loved ones ever encircling the pride and their dreamland to be their guide. And, you know, I love the storytelling here because this is their legacy. And there's a difference in, you know, in perception of different races, how they will possibly see other races. But to them, this is their sacred area, their sacred grounds, the sacred rings that are legends and are carried from each timepiece of each lifeline, their lifelines. Sorry.
No,
I got excited.
That's wonderful comments there. Yeah. I think that, you know, to me, this whole piece, it's just a magical vision. Dead souls providing solace by lulling children to sleep with nursery rhymes in their dreams amid a spiral of glistening ice particles. Wow. What wonderful imagination drips from the lines of this inspired piece. Great wordplay, too, on Saturn, where we have a divine alien presence named Sa, who forever turns the rings around Saturn, giving the planet its name. Christina has composed the first five stanzas in tercets and expanded the last stanza into a quatrain. The rings, they just get bigger as the years go by, because of what they truly are. For that, I cannot lie. The particles are held together by the souls of those that die. My name is Sa. I turn on Saturn, a flowing, glowing pattern of loved ones ever encircling their pride and to dreamland be their guide. Great rhyming and wonderful imagery throughout this well-written piece. Well done, Dark Andoras. Just remind me, sorry, Pam, did I already ask you to comment on this one?
You did, yes.
Cool, okay, so we're up to date. I think we might just about squeeze one more in that case. So I'm going to go with this, which is Venus by Dutaju. And I'll give this one a read for her. Venus by Dutaju. Socked in yellow dense clouds, the bubbling heat awaits. You inhale her. The sun is a smear in her vastness. She shines high like her siblings, admired by lands far away. Her name, is Venus, creamy, sultry and hot, stealing your breath for a while. No moonshine out before her. She stands alone. She is the legacy of love. His title is her works. Long were her wraths of the people. She had to be last of the three. With dignity out in the cosmos, she agreed to the crown. She lays in the heavens. When, alas, you are lost and weary, raise your eyes to a class of your peers, the brightest of stars, a loyal, true friend. She needs some people of her own. End poem. Louie, what did you think?
I think you did a fabulous job of reading this poem, Adudici's poem Venus. I liked the details in here, the imagery. You know, she describes her and then, you know, talks is that if you, you know, inhaling her, and that, you know, she talks about her siblings and, you know, that she's the legacy of love. And I'm going to stop there so that you and Pam can comment. Enjoyable poem.
Thank you, Lou. Pam, what do you think?
Oh, I like this. And this is a new poet's name to me. So I look forward to reading more of their poetry. And I hope that they'll be inspired to write for more of our shows. I really like how they combined elements of the mythological aspect of the goddess Venus, but also personified the planet, you know, especially with creamy, sultry, and hot, stealing your breath for a while. No moon shine out before her. She stands alone. She is the legacy of love. This title is her works. You know, this poet, just with their choice of imagery and metaphors, really brings this planet to life and shows us the spirit of the goddess. And so wonderful, right, and very well done.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, Adudici is new to me as well. They've composed a lovely piece here that eloquently describes the planet Venus through use of metaphor, mythology, and facts. I love the opening lines that capture the reader's attention. Socked in yellow, dense clouds, the bubbling heat awaits. You inhale her. The sun is a smear in her vastness. She shines high like her siblings, admired by lands far away. Her name is Venus. From there, we delve further into the mythological aspect with long were her wraths of the people. She had to be the last of the three with dignity out in the cosmos. She agreed to the crown. She lays in the heavens. Venus was closely associated with the Greek goddess Aphrodite, who is known to have vented her wrath incited by those who offered her personal slight, who scorned love or made conceited boasts. This is an imaginative rite that has been lovingly composed by Adudici and offers a different aspect to the planet Venus. So I thought it was very well done. Okay. We still have another 6 minutes. So what I'm going to do is on the end of this, I'm going to try and squeeze one more in. We may not get a chance to comment on it, but I'll do my best to try and just get through it. So this piece is called A Message to Our Earth Friends by the Tarot Writer. So for this piece, I think, if it's okay with you two, I would like to just finally read this last piece.
Mm-hmm. Go for it.
So, A Message to Our Earth Friends by the Tarot Writer. Dear Earth Friends, we have walked upon your surface many millennia ago. As we were trying to aid you in your evolution, we gave you knowledge and technology of higher intelligence. We have made initiation programs to your priests and rulers, yet we have failed in our mission, as you are still blind to truth. We apologize for this misdeed and wish to offer compensation. You may believe our planet is devoid of life, as it is extremely hot, and indeed, it is inhospitable to beings like yourself, but we are creatures of cosmic light and pure love. We are not of flesh and blood. We are what you call spirits or energy beings. If you came here with your protection gear and tried to meet us, you would fail gravely, as we can't be perceived by your physical senses. We communicate to you through your mind and consciousness, as it is no longer possible for us to dwell in physical environment. We have moved to higher dimensions of existence. Thus our home planet became hotter and brighter. We give you this message to remind you, you are not alone in the darkness. You have friends among the stars, wishing you to become united, wishing you to become one wholesome planetary race. All of your universal friends are watching closely and lament your situation. When will you see each of you as equally human, equally suffering, equally loving and hoping? We are waiting for the day we can meet as two planetary species, and at this day we will welcome you with arms wide open. We send you deep love, hope and compassion, for we see your misery. We send you thoughts of positivity to dim your global negativity. We commend you for your efforts and encourage you to continue. Continue treading the shadowed path until you can reach the warm light. May you reach there sooner than later with all the love and light, the people of Venus. End poem. So quickly, Pam, what did you think?
A beautiful and thoughtful write on a message of love and light sent to Earth from beings on a higher plane of existence. Very well done.
Thank you, Pam. And Lou, what did you think?
You know, I thought this was a fantastic letter, you know, them explaining, you know, how they tried to help us and why they no longer are here to help us, and they're in Venus, and that hoping that one day humans will reach that point where they can transcend to a higher place.
Yeah, great. Great comments from both of you. I found this to be a captivating write by Matten that echoes many of the philosophies about starseeds, indigos and lightworkers, involving the belief that enlightened interdimensional beings are in contact with and visiting us telepathically to help spread a universal message of oneness and love, to assist with our evolution and activate our own higher consciousness and awaken us to the potential of all possibilities that we possess and have the ability to change. I know this has been turned into a tale about life on Venus that has evolved to exist there without physical form, as Venus itself is hotter than Mercury, despite being further from the sun. Due to the high concentration of carbon dioxide and yellowish clouds of sulfuric acid that trap heat and blanket its atmosphere, giving rise to a runaway greenhouse effect. I thought it's very imaginatively written in the form of a message sent from our nearby neighbours. And so I say, well done, Tarot Rider. A great piece. And on that note, I wish everybody a great evening. Enjoy your Sundays. Thank you so much, Pam and Luyu, for joining me on the show tonight. And have a great day, both of you and everybody else who's been listening. And on that
note,
would you both like to say goodbye to everybody?
Have a good night, everyone.
Yes. Have a good night, everybody. Great show, Arcana. Thank you, Pam.
Thank you both for joining me.